Welcome to Volume 3 in the series, Wasanich, The Saltwater People, with Jacinctin, John Eliot. This series is dedicated to learning about the unique and rich history of the Wasanich Saltwater People and their traditional connection to their Salish Sea homeland, including Stais, South Pender Island. Jacinctin, a Wasanich elder, shares stories about his decades of time spent working at the Claywillnook Tribal School. He'll speak about the various roles he's had there over the years, as well as the important work he's done with many other people to help preserve the Tsleil-Waututh language. He will also speak about the deep importance to the Wasanich people, to the land and the natural environment. That and so much more. This recording was made in December of 2023 on the grounds of the Wasanich School Board. I am your host, Chris Wakaluk, and it is my pleasure to present this series to you. The series is made possible with grants administered by the South Pender Historical Society. I would like to thank my co-interviewer, Robert Dill, president of the SPHS. Without his help, this interview would not have been possible. Both of our voices have been extracted from this final audio in order to give maximum clarity and time to the interviewee to communicate and share their stories. Thank you for listening. Here is Jacinctin's story.
So I was quite to see him in this jet letter, Jacinctin, to this quite nice. To let the Nishkula Pala, Nichelang, a little Italy, Chartle. They call that island San Juan Island today, where that the name of that island is Stalkwith, and I wore that name for many years. And then I did many years on that name, and then my late auntie from South to Elsie Claxton. Her name is Kutskatalwit. She was doing some recordings with the Timothy Montler, who was helping to create a dictionary for the Tsleil-Waututh language. Had been recording the Tsleil-Waututh language for people for many years, and several different elders. And throughout the many years of those tapes, he heard her saying, "John Eliot's name should be Jacinctin." And so over the years, he heard that through several tapes. And so I carried the name Stalkwith for quite a while. I got that from my late father, and he named me that. And because we have a family connection over in San Juan Island, and we had some relatives still living there, just a very few left out at Stalkwith. And some of my dad's closest cousins were from there. And he used to paddle from the inside the inlet here, go around past down Sydney, and then paddle out to San Juan to visit his relatives when he was young. And because he really enjoyed being with them. And sometimes they'd come and visit us here in Joslyn, where my dad and mom's house is just down the road here. So when they were coming, it was like a special occasion when they came to visit in the summertime. And their sister's name was Addie French. And there was Uncle Carney French, Uncle John French, and Uncle Oren French. So I named one of my sons Oren, and I'm named after Uncle John. So I decided to take that name off myself and put it on one of my sons. His name's Oren. And I named my youngest daughter Addie after my Aunt Addie French, because when she used to come, she was a well-respected elder, and And we were young kids. We were always told to be on our best behavior because Auntie Addie was coming. And she's a very strict woman. So she was always checking us and disciplining us while she was here and things like that. And so I gave that name to my youngest daughter, Addie. And I moved my name, Stalkworth, to my son, Oren. So when I got an honorary doctorate from University of Victoria for all the language work that I had been doing with all the elders that we worked with here in this building, when I first started, there was like 18 fluent speakers working together in this building. I got hired on as a recorder, recording everything that they're wanting to save in Tsleil-Waututh language. My father had just created an alphabet of our own. So he taught that alphabet to myself and my sister, Linda. Her name is Kwasinia. My father would, around the table here, we had these elders here, and they would record anything and everything that they wanted to preserve or archive for the future. So that's how I got involved with the language back then. And I was hired by my late brother-in-law, Philip Paul, who was as an administrator at the time of the San Nish Indian School Board. And so myself, I got hired to do all the recordings of those elders. And my sister was doing the written work. She was recording everything that my father and those elders wanted to put together on. We used to use a chalkboard back then. So that's how I got involved with language and archiving language and such things as that. And I was learning the language as an adult because my mom and dad, they would speak together at home in the language every day. I heard their language all the time, but they never taught it to us because my mother went to boarding school and I told her, never teach your children. Never teach your children the language. And they said that to her over and over. And she saw many, many children in Keeper Island boarding school be punished for speaking the language, and was punished herself for using the language for when they were young. So she didn't want us to. She said, "Why would I teach you anything that you can be punished for?" So they didn't pass the language. So I was learning the language as an adult. I think I was around 25 years old back then. And so I was doing all the audio recordings. My sister was doing all of the written recordings in binders. And my father was writing his alphabet for our language and teaching these 18 last fluent Tsleil-Waututh speakers the written system, that how to write the things that they were talking about and wanted to talk about. So that's how I got involved with the language then. That was like 40 years ago or something now. So as I was learning the language with him, recording all these things and saving those recordings, and my sister was putting all those, archiving all those in the written binders and binders of language we did with those elders. And I was becoming more awake to and aware of what the language is really about, and how it, in our language, interprets a whole connection to the lands and the territories and our beliefs and our laws. So as I worked year after year with them, that I learned more and more about our connections to the homelands and territories. When we were doing the language recordings when we first started, and my dad was teaching all the fluent speakers that were remaining, there was 18 of them in this room, and he was teaching them the writing system that he created. So Dad spoke with Philip Paul, who was the administrator of the Senate School, Indian School Board back then, that helped him to find the most fluent speakers of the Tsleil-Waututh language. So Dad got hold of my cousin Earl to be one of them, Ivan Morris, and Manson Pelkey, and Levina Charles. He lives in Beecher Bay now. And I think there was Sammy Sam and Teresa Smith. There was Grace Horn and I can't remember all of them, but there was 18 of them. They were all really fluent in the language. So, but he wanted to teach them how to write the language, which was never written much before. My dad worked with some of the a couple of different linguists and was learning the International Phonetic Alphabet from them. But he didn't really like the writing system. He thought it was a bit complicated. At that time, it was very hard to be able to get a font that could type that, and it was very expensive for us at the time. So Dad went out and bought an old typewriter from a secondhand store for $30, so anybody could go to a secondhand store and buy a typewriter for $30. But they couldn't afford the font, which was like $1,500 or $1,800 to write the International Phonetic Alphabet. So, and then he didn't really like this system that much that they were using, and thought it was going to be difficult for the family to different families to get hold of that font. And it was became on an IBM typewriter. I believe you had to snap on the font onto the typewriter, and that was the expensive thing to get, was that the typewriter that could do that and could type the International Phonetic Alphabet. So he said, after you interviewing with some of the linguists back then, he said, I don't think this is going to work. He said, I think it's going to be a bit complicated and take them quite a while to learn all these different symbols that it takes to write the system. He said, so I think I'll make my own system, he said. And so he got that typewriter, and then so he said, I'll work on it until spring. It was in the fall. Then he started making a single space for every sound, a single letter for every sound in our language. So he worked on it from the fall until spring, and then he was finally happy with his alphabet, that he had a symbol that he could use on an ordinary typewriter. But he used to have to backspace to make the underscores or the strike throughs or the apostrophes and things above the A's and things like that. So he used to have to backspace to do that. But because it was based on a typewriter, he decided that he would use uppercase only so that it would stand out. And nobody was using uppercase only, so he thought he would use it like that, so that's what he did. So I was recording, I was doing all the recording for the school board. My sister was doing all the written recordings, and Dad was working with all those 18 fluent speakers to see what they wanted to archive and put away for the future. So, and they went over all kinds of duck list, fish list, plants and trees, and you name it. And they did a whole thing on the territory, homelands and territories. And so over the years, I was learning more and more about what it meant to be able to speak the language, but have that vision from our worldview of the world, how we lived and how our people lived in. And that's all embedded in the language, and it includes our laws and our belief systems and our own disciplines, the way their people live. Through that, it's all included in that. You know, when I first started, I didn't realize that it was so inclusive to our whole way of living, and where we lived and how we lived, and all our different activities, and even cooking and hunting and fishing, all that was all included in that understanding. So I was learning along the way. And as time went on, they ended up putting me in a classroom. I didn't feel I was ready to go in a classroom, but it was just little tiny kids. And so they had a curriculum for me to follow. So I agreed, because one of our elders was in class all the time. He was in there. He was the first one to go in, and then it was getting harder for him to make the classes. And so I was ended up being myself and my cousin, Yul Kwitsa, Earl Clarkson Senior, so he said, "You go in. You're ready. You're good enough to go in." So I said, "Okay." So I ended up teaching in the kindergarten and nursery. And because the former teacher, or my other cousin, Manson, couldn't make the classes all the time. I think he was suffering the trauma of the boarding schools and that. He was just not dependable, and some days he just wasn't well enough to come into class. So Earl says, you got to take his place. Somebody's got to be there every day, so you better take his place. I said, oh, okay. So I ended up teaching, starting out in nursery and kindergarten. Then I ended up going from grade to grade, and I taught from nursery school to grade 11 over the many years. And I saw all those elders. They passed away one by one by one. And there was the last ones I remember that I was working with was Cousin Earl, Cousin Ray, Sam from South, Helen Jack, myself, and my sister Lindy and Rose Henry. They were those are the last ones that were here after the elders had all gone, including my cousin Earl. So how I got into this, talking about this, was because of how I changed my name. Because I wore Stalkwell for many years. And then after working with all these elders and doing this kind of work and working throughout the school, Timothy Monter had come across Auntie Elsie over several years, saying John's name should be Jacinton. John's name should be Jacinton, and different over years he would say that. And so the University of Victoria gave me honorary doctorate for working on the language for so many years. So on that night, my late cousin Lou and cousin Belinda, they insisted that I take that name that night, Jacinton, that their mom wanted me to take on. So I left, put my Stalkwell name on one of my sons, and I took on that name, Jacinton. That's how I got to the talking about all this in the beginning. But I know we're here to talk about the islands and things like that, but that's how I ended up being involved with language and coming to the understanding of how we, our people, have that connection. My father was a fisherman. I mean, that's what he did most of his life. And he went throughout all those islands, and they went digging clams, hunting ducks, and or hunting deer or whatever. Any kind of gathering out in those islands was just common back in the day to be able to do that kind of thing. And that's how a lot of that generation, those speakers, were. They knew that freedom, just that freedom to just go out, fish, hunt, dig clams, get crabs, whatever they wanted to do in our territory. That was common in those days. So a lot of the language that they were preserving here in this room was all about their own lifestyle, what they were doing, the freedoms that they had, and or the freedoms that they were losing at the time as well, because there was a lot of interference with our own natural rights by the game wardens and all of their regulations, and they were kind of suppressing our people to be disconnected, because they would be harassed by the game wardens if they were fishing or if they were hunting or if they were digging clams. I mean, that was just a common, ordinary way of living, that if they went to whichever island to dig clams, a game warden would come along and spill their clams and make them, intimidate them to not to be living that way. That happened to a lot of the ones that were gathered here in that generation. And at the same time, in the times of their lives, some of them were sent off to boarding school, divided from their parents and elders, and tried to deny them the right, their own natural right, their chalang and their ancestry to be able to speak the languages. And even when I was young and going to school, and the boarding schools are starting to close down, and they opened Indian Day School, which is on this grounds here, we were being taught by nuns, and they too were suppressing us in that way, because I know they used to ask, does your mother go to the longhouse? I said, yeah, she goes to the longhouse. Yeah. And I said, do you go there? They said, do you go there? Yeah, we go down and watch sometimes. And then said, you shouldn't go down there. That's an evil place. And that's a heathen religion. That's what they said to me when I was young, in this day school here on this ground. So we're losing our connections to those places. And when I look back at it now, I see that the reason why they wanted our language stamped out is because our language speaks about all those things, all that way of living, all that way of life, about our history, our ancient history here on this land. So through sitting with those elders and listening to them over the years, I learned that that our whole way of life was really, really all in the language, in our worldview within the language, to how we connect to, maybe it's one of the islands, like our family was really connected to Sqsak, which is main island. And some of the other families had their family connections to Stais, Tlaqtaqsin, which is Saturna, and other islands, and Stalkwit as well, because I was talking earlier about how we have a connection out there with some of our family. We're still in a connection with those ones that are from Stalkwit, but they only go to there now, where Aunt Addie's house used to be. All that's left on her property is a little garage, car garage. So they go out there and they stay in the car garage every summer and visit with one another. And then we try to connect with them in that summertime. All their elders are gone. It's just the younger generation, like my generation, is still alive. That still go out to Stalkwit. But that's the way it was. When families had a connection to an island, they tried to maintain that connection. They tried to, and we still do today, try to maintain that connection. So one of the first things that changed is they made the border between the American side and this Canadian side. And so Stalkwit to San Juan Island, where our relatives, where my father visited since he was just young, strong enough to paddle over here to by himself to visit his cousins. That changed because now he has to cross the border. And that was another harassment that was happening, that they didn't want the people going back and forth across the border, although that was part of our natural territory where people visited and had relatives and that. So that was all, when I look back at it now, it was a form of suppression and oppression for our people to not to be who we are as a people that travels within the territory. So I remember talking to my cousins, Earl and Manson, who were part of that first language group, and how they were still living that way, going out to anywhere to fish, to hunt, to get crabs or dig clams, have a fire, whatever they wanted to, anywhere. They could go freely as younger people. That's a lot. I heard a lot of that the kind of discussion from that first group of 18 people where I had come in to learn language. And I never ever thought that I would become a teacher of the language. And it was never my intention. All I wanted to do was learn about the language, learn about what it was all about. When I look back at the last 40 years of working on the language and the influence that those elders had on my mind, on the way that I think that I was very, very lucky to be able to spend that time with them, each one of them, while they were here. And I ended up teaching in, like I was saying, from nursery school throughout the grades. And we were building that curriculum, myself and my late cousin Earl. Because Earl was well spoken in the language, and he was well read also in English. And really, we had a lot of fun working in this room. We worked here together in this room for 28 years together. And that's quite a while to spend on learning language. And all the time I was learning. And he was always to test me on the board. He always to test me what I knew, and if I could spell everything correctly, because I always put notes on the board, have to interpret. And or he'd tell me to leave a note for him. I always leave, because he was teaching other classes. He was teaching the classes from 4 to 8, and I was teaching the younger classes. And then it came to the time, and I'd have to go to class. This was our central place we'd come back to, there'd be a note on the board and tell me, what does it say? I'd have to read and tell him. And he told me to leave notes on the board for him, and I'd come down here, and then he'd look at my what I had written for him on the board, and then he'd correct it for me. Pretty close, this is where it needs to be done here. So this is how you would say that. And he would do that. And then he says, the reason I'm teaching you is because you're going to have to answer the question. What the kids want, they're going to ask you all kinds of questions. I'm not going to be here forever. Somebody has to give them the answers. You have to have an answer for anything and everything they're going to ask you. I didn't want to even hear that because I wanted him to stay. That's what we call the Nehemet. Nehemet in the language is your family's most ancient name that you have in your family and where that person was from. So more than likely they have a connection to either any one of those islands out there where their ancestor was from, when they were living within that kind of a freedom where they could just be themselves without any interference. And the natural, what we call itlaqsila, which is passing down history, stories, land history or names and things from, that was part of what we call our chilangin, which is our birthright to do when we're living in our natural life. So every family has a nehemet, which is an ancient name that belongs to your family where you have a connection to. Whichever island you're from, or where your relatives are from, so that's how we have that certain connection to those islands. And when our people were living there, without the interference of any colonizers or anything, that they were just living a natural life, and they're being taught about those islands, the history of those islands, what kind of activities they were doing there, and such things as that came along with that Nehemet. Or ancient family name that you're born into. That you're born into that as a Sanic person. So those are the kind of things that I was learning from those elders back in the day. So it's still that way today. And there's also sacred societies that are held within the nation that we belong to. You're born into those. It's part of your. It's part of what you're born into. And those were the, what we call Tzochtein, which is mean society. But those are our ways of maintaining connection with the real ancient past through our, maybe a relative, an ancestor that carried that right to that society. It was a society for the, they're looking after the sea, society for looking after the plants and growing things. There's a society that connects us to the animal kingdom and other societies that we don't even talk about. That's the things that we have connections to, and we're born into that through that. And maybe that connection could be one of those islands out there where they were living in the village long, long ago. So. That's the way that it is for the Sanish people, and it's always been that way. And I don't think those societies will ever die away. They'll live on, regardless, because it's our laws. It's our own governance. That's how we governed ourselves, through those ancient societies. And those were the things that give us the right to be connected to our homelands and territories. Well, over in Steyes, there's an example of that. The Steyes, the name Steyes itself, if you interpret it, it comes from the reason why our people went there. They went there to make dried fish, dried salmon. It's called stale. And when you're happy and joyful, it's called Eyes. When you put those two together, it's Steyes. The place for that you go to wind dry, the happy place where you go to wind dry fish, because that's a bountiful That's a very bountiful area for the salmon runs that go through there. And it's always been that way. And that was part of our connection and our understanding that we value those places. We value that connection. And we value it. And Pender Island, we don't know what that really means. Probably one of the colonizers that took it, I guess. I'm thinking it must be. I don't know who Pender was. But if you say Stegis, has a totally different meaning to us about that place. And one has an ancient connection of happy times, joyful times. Doing what we did naturally is to get our food, and it's a natural way of our people to move out to those islands and do those natural activities through the summer months when the fish is around, when the fish runs are going through there. And not just the fish, but the berries and the plants and those things that we needed to gather for the coming colder season, fall season, winter season. We call that activity kalang. It means you're working on your stored foods, and skalang are your stored foods, and it comes along with some of the other beliefs that we have that we should be working, hard working in our life. When Creator changed one of our ancestors long ago, her name was Chia. Her human name was Chia. And she was hardworking, ambitious, and a person who was grateful and who was preparing food for the future. And she was picking malsung, which is called blueberries. Used to be a lot of blueberries at one time here. And she couldn't believe the bountifulness of the land because her baskets were getting filled so fast. So she stopped and she prayed. And she gave thanks to the Creator for the bountifulness of the land. And she was a very hardworking and ambitious person. And she was thankful for what she had. And those berries that she was picking was going to be for the future use. So she had these little frames. She used to press them down into these little frames and dry them in the sun. And so Creator heard her prayer, and he appeared to her back in ancient times. And he said, Chia, because you're a hardworking person, because you're grateful for what you have, and because you're thinking of the future, he says, I'm going to change you today. I'm going to change you. And I want this way to be remembered here in this area. So he changed her to the blue jay bird. And her hands are all blue from picking berries. He says, and I'll make you the color of the ambition on your hands. So that was one of the stories that, those kind of stories about creation days. And so he changed Chia to be the blue jay bird. And that blue bird that's here now today outside, we call her Chia. That's her bird name. We call her Chia. But it doesn't just mean Chia. It means something else, too. It means we should be hardworking in life. We should be ambitious. And we should not just think of today, but think of the future. And that's a message to us. And that's the way that our people got to be the way they were and are still today. Throughout the summer, you'll see our people trying to get as much as food as they can. What's left of it today? Try to get a bit of fish, try to get some berries, try to preserve some things for the winter, and in a way, try to be the way that our ancestors were. And through these difficult times, even though that we're blocked from many of our own places, our own natural places where we always have gone to. And they told us when there's a lot of blue jays around in the fall, it usually means that there's probably going to be a heavier snow this winter. It might last a little bit longer, and we'll need that. So That's a lot for us. And that's why our people went everywhere in those islands, fished, hunted, picked berries, gathered roots and medicines and stored it for the winter. There was no freezers. There was no stores. It had to be ready for the coming harder months when all of the growing season is done. You have to have all your skalong or your stored foods put away for the winter. And many of the families are still that way. They do all the best they can. And even though we're kind of held in a way to the reserve, and they kind of locked us up on the reserve. And the freedom to go to any of those beautiful places got locked down over the years. Our rights to lands and our connections to our natural Nahimat places, it changed because the language was dying off and that. And that. So it's been a huge journey for myself to see all that happening over the years, and to also become aware of our ancestry and our ancestors and our ways of being and living is part of what we've been doing. Well, the way I look at it now is that, you know, we were really, really lucky that we had really strong elders that wouldn't give up the language. All the things that went through with the suppression of the language was very, very, very difficult times. And I'm happy for those 18 fluent elders that came here and worked with the school board, our own school board, because it was that time we were taking over control of our own education here. It was the Mother's Club and the leaders of the day that decided to have a school here where we could have some say over what the children were being taught. And the leader was late Philip Paul, and the counselors of the day and the Mother's Club worked together to help bring back, make sure that we have some control over what the children are learning about and learning about us as a people. And I'm really grateful that they had the strong elders that held on, even though there was really, really, they were living through a very difficult time. And they put together all those things and built a strong foundation, a new strong foundation for the time we're living in now. In their age, in the time they were living the natural life of being everywhere and anywhere on the land and with more freedom. And then as time went on, and then our people were losing control of our natural places where we go. I heard the elders talk a lot about that. So when they were archiving everything that they wanted archived together as a group, I see that they built a really strong foundation of what they wanted to see for the future. And when I think of our young people today, and like I've worked here for 40 years in this school, for the Saanich School Board. They used to call it Saanich Indian School Board, now they've changed it to Saanich School Board. Even that has changed. With the more say over who's hired around here, and we decide for ourselves what we want the children to have to learn about their homelands, our territories, and with the base being the Tsleil-Waututh language. And over the years, it has grown and grown and grown. And more, we spent at least 25 years of building capacity. And I still believe we still are building capacity for being able to have our own teachers and speak it in our language all day, every day to our children. But we're to that point now where we have immersion classes from nursery to grade 10. And that's been a huge leap for us in regard to returning our right to speak, our right to pray and think, our right to sing a song in our own language. It's come a long ways, and I give thanks to those elders that were so determined to be able to have that. And I see our young people are developing into strong young people that speak the language, sing in the language, perform in the language, and pray in the language. I see them dancing where they never used to dance. In the protocols of every day at this school, the teachers and the kids go up to the gym and they have their song about the school in the language where they go at Xiaowang School out. And then they sing songs about the homelands. The homelands are sacred, the song says. Mountains are sacred, the rivers are sacred, the ocean is sacred, the salmon are sacred, our homeland is sacred. They sing that every day, and they dance and sing to that, and they drum together, and the ladies hold the rattles. And I see the children, and even the non-First Nations teachers, singing and dancing along with the children. What a wonderful change it's been to see that. When I first saw that, I got emotional and I cried because it's been a long struggle. And it's just such a beautiful thing to see that has come to that now. And I see the young people that wouldn't even drum. They wouldn't even sing with me when I sang, first started singing here at the school. Some of them now are leading the songs in the gym. Beautiful, strong voices. And now they have a song for every moon. Every month has its own song, you know, and they give honor to our Saanich calendar year and what that moon brings to our people. They sing about our Chulalongit, our first ancestor, Rain. They have a song about that. They sing about traveling on the sea. So with that kind of a base and finally returning to being First Nations, our Saanich, without any shame, no hindrances in their way. And they're also learning the regular curriculum that. So there's two streams in our schools, the Chawthon stream and an English stream. So they learn both. And I remember back in the day when they made a film about taking over or control of our education, they said they have to have the best of both worlds, the best of our world and the best possible education that our English teachers and Chawthon teachers could give them. And I see that happening now. So that was a dream of the elders. I used to hear them talking about it. I see it's happening. I see it's happening. So they're really, really strong young people. They're learning about the plants from Cousin Earl and Apakia and those other ones that are helping in packing out, learning about plants, learning about returning the strength back to such places as Sneetquit over there in Fiamatjung and other places where they're working, some of the other islands where they're working in Steyes and Tuktuksin. Where those, where they go and have programs and making that connection with the people there. You know, I remember those times because we worked on farms when we were kids. We worked for the farmers. Some were really, really nice, good people, and some treat us like dogs. They were mean to us, and. I don't think it did them much good being mean. It's like my cousin said, there is a payback for what you do. In our language, we call unskill, whatever you put out in life, it's going to return to you or your family, and that day will come. I guess some people call it, they call it karma. That's our, we believe about karma. We call it anskau. If you're even mean to a dog, if you're a kid and you go walk along and you kick a dog, you could get really in trouble from our parents if you did something like that. And they're going to tell you mustn't be mean to anything. You must be mean to anything in life or unkind. So we lived through a lot of that. Those unkind times where there were some people that just were just awful, and others were very kind. We worked with some good farmers. We worked with some good farmers. Some farmers just treat us real good. We work hard for them, get in their potatoes and their hay and whatever, but they'd give us a break and bring us a little cup of tea and such things as that. And others, they would just work you nearly to death and then treat you bad to boot. So those times, and you know, they call this a time of truth and reconciliation. The truths are going to be coming out for a long time yet, because those young people are performing those truths. They're going to perform those through songs and plays and stories, and those are going to be coming out for a long time yet. And it's just telling about our history together and what we've lived through. They ask about, what do you call reconciliation? And they asked us as a language group, what do you call reconciliation? And we said, well, maybe we could call it slechwetnangat. It means peace of mind at last. Not just for us, but for those ones that imposed those unfair, unjust ways on. There's some guilt in the colonizers that live on our places. They took it over. They never gave us a chance. They never gave us a chance to have economic freedom anymore once they took our places. They took it without consultation, and they left us in these little reserves. They made two descriptions of land: fee simple title and certificate of possession land. Certificate of possession land is on the reserves. You can't go to the bank with your land if you live on a reserve. They say, you can't borrow money because you live on a reserve. Out there on the fee simple title, on the other side of the road, where the fee simple title land people live, they can say, oh, I have this acreage here. Can I borrow money? Sure, you can borrow money. You want to start a business? Go ahead. So that's been, we've been held down economically. We have no economic freedom in many ways still today, because of us being percentage people. And I'm hoping that someday that it will become fair and just in this world, where all First Nations will have an opportunity to be treated fair and just like they should be. And then that guilt will be gone. Don't have to carry that guilt or that age of suffrage in your memory, like we have been doing for years and years. I'm hoping that one day that we can do some good things together, and hoping that an interview like this today, what we're doing, is going to help people understand and maybe free up some of that lack of knowledge and become more knowledgeable about the kind of way that our people have been treated for so long, so that we can look at one another in the eye. It's the question on it. You can look one another in the eye with peace in your heart. That's what I talk about with that. So that's what I have to say about that. Yeah. Yeah, so this land that we're on here has been designated as this land to be used for education. Well, this building we're in, this here, was the first schoolhouse, on reserve schoolhouse. And it was built in 1916. So this is probably the oldest one, I believe, in BC. This one here, this building we're in, it was built by some of the people right from here. And I think my grandfather, Isaac Bartlemy, was one of them. that helped to build this house, and probably other members from Otlas Pier. So it's been renovated a few times, I think. But I remember that my cousin Earl said that around Christmas time they used to have they introduced the idea of Christmas and all that business and Santa Claus and all that business like that. And they had one of the elders, his name was Chris Paul. See that hole up there? He was hiding in there. Then they knocked on us from up there. And they said, "Who is it?" "It's Santa Claus," they were saying. And then Chris gave him a ladder and he came down the ladder. So that was quite a long time ago. And I remember when we first moved in here, it was really cold. It was kind of not being used, this building. But Philip Paul, when he had built it for the elders to be saving language, and then he bought nice tables like this for them, kind of like executive chairs. He said, "These are your teachers. These are our elders, and they're your teachers. They're our professors." That's what he told me when we came in here too. And he says, "You learn what you can," he said. Because late Philip Paul went to boarding school when he was a boy. And when he went there, he had long hair. And his hair was kind of curly. They cut his hair all off. And he saw all the starvation. And he was part of the starvation, that where they were starving the children. And they gave them bad food. So when he became a strong leader through his life and worked for the Union of BC Indian Chiefs and worked with the National Chief George Manuel, and then he moved home to work in the community as a leader of the Saanich Indian School Board. He wanted to make a place and a beautiful place for the elders to sit where they felt respected. So he turned this into their place, into the elders' place, this room. And he said, "They deserve those nice chairs," he said. And they're our professors. And he wanted language to be protected and perpetuated as a part of their mission statement back in that time when they were doing this. And so this place has been developed and put in place to help to bring the language back and a revival, survival of the Tsleil-Waututh language. And that's what this place has been used for since. And the next school after this building was a three-room school, which just where these other buildings aren't here now. And it was run by the nuns and the priests. And they had no say over the curriculum or what that. And so one night that school burnt down. Didn't know who burnt it down, but somebody burnt it down. And they had brought in some trailers to take its place. And they even had to add on addition on the end of that, which was just another building that was brought in and bumped up against those trailer units. When I first came here, the administrator and chairman was one position. And then they had their office was a little trailer on the end, just a little trailer, about as long as this. And then they had other trailers that were brought in from outside and connected them all together. And that was to take the place of our school, which had been burned down. So they stayed in there, and they still used this a bit, this little old building. And then the school got together with the Department of Indian Affairs, and because they promised them that they were going to build a new school after that one went down, burnt down. And so they built a new school up there, and they wanted to have our style of art on that building. That was all through the direction of the school board chair and their committee. They had a project manager, and the project manager worked with them through the construction of that building. Well, my father was working with them then, and he passed away. And it was really hard for me to come back to work on language, so I took 1 year off from that. And that year, that 1 year off that I took off from that, I got hired on as a carpenter's helper up there, and a laborer, I suppose, with the team that was our own people building that new school. So I was back a number and digging dirt, and then they changed me to another job, so I ended up working with plumbers underneath the school. So I was under the building for six weeks helping the plumbers put pipes together. And then one day Phillips gets to the opening on the subfloor. "John, you better come back now. Come on back to work. You're going back to work with Earl." "Oh, okay. Be down there next Monday. You guys are going to be teaching together again." Okay, so I came back here. So that's how I ended up back in language. I had to come back. And we ended up doing that work. But this school was then dedicated to language preservation, the one we're in. It had been a one-room school when late cousin Earl and Ray and I, when we were kids in here, when they went to school. So this little building's here been a long time. So from then on at that school, when they opened the new school, it was like a celebration. And I remember them, they wanted to put a pole in front of the school. So they hired my mother to be the carver, because he was a carver. He was ahead of several other carvers and artists to put all our own designs on our own art style. This is a Coast Salish design, which is the art style of the area here. So they designed that, and we had our own First Nations carpenters working up there, and they built that new school. And when they talked to the elders, and they wanted to know the symbols that were the strongest symbols for our people, and so that was the thunderbird, the raven, the whale, and the wolves. So they wanted a design made for that, a design made out of that to be the design symbol for the school, or logo for the school. I was doing some artwork back then, and then Philip came to me and he said, "Can you draw us a design for the school? The elders want this on it, and they want that on it." And I said, "Okay, I think I can do that," because I was doing quite a bit of artwork back then. And so I thought it was going to be easy to incorporate those one into a circle. And I tried and tried, and oh my God, I kept throwing it away. And then I said, "I think I better do a little prayer." And I fasted. Then after my fast was done, and I sat down, and I got it done in a short while. And that's still the same logo that they have today for the whole school. That was my part of my art part of this school. That's been some, like 40 years ago or something. So this place has been growing and growing and growing. We had no place for an adult center. So the adult center, we bought it off of Commotion College. They were going to tear it down on Interurban Road. So they made an agreement with Commotion College and had it taken apart and put up right there. We paid $1 for that building over there. And some people were angry at us because we did that. But the school board did that, because it was getting an older building to put on here. But I mean, like, it was still good material. It was still good. They put it back together, and they made it safe. And that's where adult programs take place. So it's grown and grown, and it's come to be really connected to the University of Victoria and Commotion College, and have programs throughout connecting us with all the things that are happening here today, you know, the gardening program and the language program, and the young people getting language as well in the adult center, and they're choosing their careers and working along with the other programs that are around. So the this place has been going since then and has been growing since. And we just had a big addition on the school in the last 2 years, and it's they I think they added on like up there, so they have an English stream side and a South Cinchathan stream side up there, which is just you just get Cinchathan in all the grades, and then they have to take their English courses on this other side of the school in the same building, but they all work together really close like now. So I think the dream of those elders is coming to fruition now, that that they must be happy to see what has gone on over the years. And over the years, there's a dictionary that's been made with all our elders that were being interviewed by Timothy Monter. I worked a long time with Auntie Elsie Claxton, Vi Williams, and Uncle Guy Bartleman, and several other elders that they were recording back in the day. And so we have that dictionary. And I saved all those recordings that we did here. And we just had them digitalized not too long ago. And we're making another book called the Davy Village and Cinchathan Legacy Book, which is developing all these lists of every word that they could come up with, and adding like sentences to all of them so they know how to be used properly, and all the different parts of things that's going to be. We're doing that still today, and probably finished maybe another year or so, and that'll be further developed by the next generation to make it into more resources. Any stories that were interpreted into English and they were just off of tapes, we interpret all into written language now. That's been the job of myself and Celilia, my cousin Belinda, and my sister Quasinia. That's what we do when we're online most of the time, when we're not in classes. So that's what's still going on here today. And that's an ongoing work that's just, you know, like I told my young teachers when I was teaching them, I said, you know, we did one leg in the last 40 years. You guys take the next leg forward. You got lots to do yet. It'll never end. And you have to do your best at what you do. That's what we told them. So I think each generation will take on their responsibility as we had to, and be a part of that. So we're lucky to have them learning about their homeland, their language, their plants, their medicines, and how to use to properly do the foods and things like that. That's so important to being Saanich. And I think that was the hope and dream of the elders, that we could get that done.
Thank you very much to Jacinctin for doing this interview. This interview and the entire series has been made possible with funding from the Capital Regional District, the Pender Island Community Resource Center, the Wasanich Leadership Council, Wasanich School Board, the Pender Islands Museum, and the South Pender Historical Society. Thank you to all these organizations for contributing to make these recordings possible.